Have y'all heard that story before?
No.
I didn't think so. It's a new story to me too, to be honest. There's a lot more to it than just these 11 verses that Bob read for us. And Mala Noahola Milka and Tirza's story is an incredible story. Their whole story with you, but I didn't want to give Bob the entire. The womanist scholar that Bethany and I have mentioned many times calls this one of the most important stories in Scripture. And throughout this, I am drawing heavily on her interpretation of this story. First to note is that out of the 1,426 personal names in just the Hebrew Testament, only about 111 of them are for women. So the fact that all five daughters are named in this story is significant. The sisters appear in five different places in the book of Numbers, Joshua, and finally in the book of First Chronicles. All five of them are out of those places. This is significant. We are supposed to pay attention to them. They first appear in chapter 26, which is just an accounting of the names of the descendants of the Israelites. God had commanded Moses to take a census of the Israelites and then apportion land in Canaan to them, to the males of the household. The sisters are named as the only daughters, the only descendants of Zelophehad. Zelophehad had no sons, the daughters were not married, so according to the law at the time, Zelophehad's inheritance would die with him and no apportionment would be given to the daughters. The daughters then, as we read in this story, come to Moses and demand that their father's inheritance be given to them. Now the women don't just come forward, they position themselves between Moses and the chief priests and the tent of meeting, which is where the people believed that God resided. We're going to come back to that positioning later. The sisters also don't ask Moses to change the law, they demand that the law be changed. Moses could have decided their case right there. He had decided other cases brought by women on his own before, but for some reason, he decides to take this particular case to God. And God declares that the sisters are right, and that the law should be changed to allow them to receive their father's inheritance. Let me say that again. The women bring a petition before God. God hears their plea, and God changes God's mind and the Torah, the law, to provide for them. But not only that, God calls them righteous. The NRSV translation here uses the word right, but Wilda Gaffney says that this Hebrew word more closely means righteous. This particular use of this Hebrew word is not attributed to God anywhere else except God saying it about these women. So not only did God hear their petition and change the Torah to fulfill first place. Well, this was a big win for women's rights. It was not a slam dunk. The new law only provided for the women to inherit the land if they had no brothers. Still, it was a major move forward. Later in the book of Numbers, we see some of the male leaders come and they try to claw back this new inheritance right for women. Now, I know it's hard to believe that some men might work to undermine and reverse women's rights, but stay with me here. The men come to Moses expressing concern that if the daughters inherit the land and then marry someone outside of their tribe, that the land will then get unevenly distributed, and some tribes will get more land than other tribes. Moses, of course, agrees with the men, and he declares that the women can get the land, but they have to marry within their own tribe. So they still get their land, but now the sisters agree to this stipulation. But there's a couple of interesting notes here. First, Moses does not consult God this time. He takes God's previous judgment in the case and changes it. Moses also then uses that same word righteous that God used for the women, but applies it to the men this time. He essentially strips the women of their agency here. On the surface, they're still inheriting their father's land, but only if they marry within their tribe. And then, of course, the control of the land presumably moves to their husbands. And we don't hear from the sisters again until partway through the book of Joshua. And this next bit is a bit of speculation on Wilda Gaffney's part, but I think it's really interesting. Before we see the sisters again in Joshua, the Israelites cross over to the Promised Land, but Moses doesn't get to go with them. Moses does not get to see the Promised Land, and the Bible itself is contradictory and unclear. In Numbers, God says to Moses, "You did not trust me to show my holiness before the eyes of the Israelites. Therefore, you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them." Now, Gaffney says, she reads this to mean that Moses did not obey God's command to allow the women to inherit. She cites other places where Moses' attitude toward women is questionable, in the way he sometimes uses his power to disenfranchise women. Then she compares his actions to those of modern civil rights leaders who worked tirelessly for civil rights while simultaneously denying women equal rights within that struggle. Whatever you think of why Moses was not allowed to enter the Promised Land, it is a good reminder that we humans, especially the heroes that we laud and celebrate, are complicated and imperfect human beings just like us. Once in the Promised Land, though, Mala, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah go to their new leader, Joshua, and again demand their right to inherit their father's land without restriction, reminding Joshua that God declared this. And in stark contrast to Moses, Joshua immediately awards them the inheritance. And finally, the final mention of these sisters is in a genealogy list that they have children. We don't know if they ever married or whether their line continued from there, but their legacy has lived on for many generations. Their story is often cited as one of the first documented legal cases, certainly one of the first ones granting rights to women. As recently as 1924, the quote, "daughters of Zelophehad" were cited in an American Bar Association Journal article as a declaratory decision on women's inheritance rights. Right. Aside from the questionableness of citing the Bible for American legal proceedings, what a remarkable story and legacy that these five women have had on the world, all because they dared to stand up before their leaders and demand their equal rights. Bethany and I were at a conference on faith and climate change for most of this week, so I've been a little later writing my sermon this week than usual, but I said to Bethany, their story is so compelling on its own, I hardly need to say much more about it. The issues these women faced are so present even today, and I'm sure y'all have been drawing parallels to current and historical political situations already, but there's two things I want to draw your attention to that I noticed in this story. First, I love any story where a person or a group of people take issue with something, argue their case before God, and God relents. Christians often preach that God is unchanging, but our scriptures say otherwise. It is filled with stories of people arguing with God and God hearing their pleas and changing course. At the climate conference this week, we read a part of the book of Joel where the prophet describes a terrible calamity that is befalling the earth, earthquakes and fires and darkness all across the land. The whole earth trembles. But Joel encourages the people to cry out to God for mercy, saying, "Who knows? God may relent." The people of Israel have always believed that their relationship with God is dynamic, not static, that God hears the people's cries and takes their pleas into consideration. In the UCC, we phrase that as God is still speaking. Not only is our relationship with God dynamic, but God calls those who bring their concerns to God and demand change righteous. The second thing I noticed is that position that the women take when they make their demand to Moses. As the people wandered in the desert, rather than a permanent temple, Moses would construct a tent of meeting whenever they stopped, where he would go and consult with God, the people believed that God's very presence resided in that tent, so only Moses could enter the tent. When he would hear cases from the people, Moses and the chief priests would position themselves between the people and the tent of meeting. It was a place of power, signifying that they were the intermediaries between God and the people. When the women brought their demand, they took this place, effectively declaring that they needed no intermediary between God and them. They could take their demand directly to God. It was an incredibly bold and powerful move. They not only declared their own power and humanity, but then they reflected that power, that humanity, back to the male leaders, especially Moses and the chief priests. And they said that they too can come before God. They too bear the image of God. They too have rights and privileges. And not only for them, but for all of the women, those gathered, and every woman in the generations to follow. I've been thinking this week about other people who have put themselves in that in-between position, and so many examples come to mind. I listened to an episode of the NPR podcast Throughline. The episode was called Daring to Dissent. The host tells the story of Sophie Scholl, a member of the White Rose Project. White Rose was a resistance group of university students who created anti-fascist, anti-war pamphlets and distributed them to protest and disrupt the Nazi regime in Germany. Sophie and her brother Hans, who was under threat from the Nazis for allegedly being homosexual, went to the University of Munich to distribute these pamphlets. They left them in piles all over campus for other students to find. But then from a balcony, Sophie opened the briefcase of the pamphlets, allowing them to just cascade over the students. Sophie and Hans were both arrested, tried for treason, and then executed for distributing those pamphlets. Sophie's and Hans' actions obviously didn't end the war, but the podcast host says something that stuck with me. He said, "It matters that they tried. It matters that they made the attempt." Someone did take the pamphlet that they were distributing that day, smuggled it out of Germany into Britain, where it was reproduced, and then dropped by planes all over Germany. It mattered that they tried. It matters that they placed themselves in that place between God and the Nazi regime, demanding change, exposing lies, asserting their humanity, and the humanity of all the Jews and homosexuals and all the people that the Nazis targeted. You can probably name many other examples. Greta, that Bethany talked about. People who have stood in this gap, people who have placed themselves between God and the people, declaring their humanity and demanding their rights. From the women's suffrage movement to the civil rights movement to the riots at Stonewall to the students who set up encampments on college campuses, or the protesters yesterday who created a living red line around the White House, even to the child brave enough to stand between a bully and the person who is being bullied. All of these folks follow in the footsteps of Mala, Noah, Hova, Milka, and Tirzah as they boldly place themselves in that in-between place, demanding change or an end to violence, or simply asking to be seen as fully human, fully deserving of a place before God. If you look at the front of your bulletin, one of the things I like about Maureen Wright Pittman's depiction of this story is that the women appear to be standing in a V shape. Being the one standing in the gap is not easy, and we are not all called to be the one out on the front line demanding change, placing our bodies on the line, and that's okay. Any movement for change needs people on the front lines and people playing support roles in the background. Both places take courage and faith. However they stood, those sisters were there together, supporting one another, sharing the risk each in. They were stronger together, and their names are forever said together. Mala, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. Wherever you find yourself, at the front of the bee, or standing in a supportive position, may we all find inspiration in the story of these sisters. May we have the courage to speak up for our own humanity and the humanity of others. And may we remember that God not only welcomes voices of dissent, God calls them righteous.